All right, this is like a podcast except live with real people smiling at me. It's very nice to see you all in person. I'm very happy if our meeting today ends up like this image of a meeting in a Russian factory in 1920 of women workers, obviously in heated debate about something. I'm not sure what they're debating, but if people want to get fired up in here, I highly welcome that. So, yeah, if you think anything I say needs a response that warrants standing on a chair and pointing, bring it. I'm into it. Now, here's a long quote to begin with. Often this quote is used at the end of talks like this, and it's a quote from Engels from a book that was published in 1884 on the family private property in the state. And the first part of it is to basically say, we don't know what sexuality and relationships and gender even will be like in a society that's not capitalist. But there's a bit in the middle that really struck me in today's climate and all of the things that we've seen in the past few weeks, the stories, the revelations of a whole series of absolutely disgusting sexual assaults that have been happening in the heart of politics, of what people consider politics to be in this country in Canberra. And Engels wrote, we'll have a generation of men who never in their lives have known what it is to buy a woman's surrender with money or any other social instrument of power. A generation of women who have never known what it is to give themselves to a man from any other considerations than real love. Engels was a bit of a romantic. Or to refuse to give themselves to their lover from fear of the economic consequences. Social instruments of power and economic consequences are threads that run through all of the stories that we've been hearing, I think, from Canberra and from all sorts of other places now as well. And Engels, when he published this book, was absolutely ridiculed. It was sort of like the howling masses of the liberal establishment at that point in time said, Engels, you're fucking crazy, basically. What is this crazy shit that you're writing about women and the family? And the same arguments were made then about the naturalization of this kind of behavior, right? And the relationships between men and women, as we hear today in 1884. They said the same things. It's natural. This is the natural way of things. And today we hear that essentialism, that gender essentialism, summed up in phrases like boys will be boys. And the excuses that people make for the behavior of boys and men, and particularly elite and powerful boys and men, boys will be boys. What does that mean? That means we think that behavior is natural then, something essential about it, something biological. And Engels and Marx thought the same thing that I think, that that's a load of crap. And they tried to express that in a lot of different ways. And I think it's absolutely amazing, in fact, that they did that in this time period when they were under way more pressure than any of us in 2021 around their ideas to do with gender and sexuality. So often, again, at the beginning of these talks, people go through like, here's some examples of sexism today or whatever. I kind of don't need to do that, really. I don't really need to remind you. So I thought I'd just share these Christian Porter's tears, which he can fucking choke to death on. And best buddies are Donald Trump and our own Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. And the fact that, you know, all of the things that Trump did, just sort of people kind of lost interest in the gross, vile sexism of Donald Trump because it sort of became so normal, you know, in a way that actually when you read books from socialists and from feminists in the 1970s, like the radicalism around how you should be treated in the 70s now, just kind of makes 2021 seem really fucking backward and conservative. And there's lots of other examples of that, and I'll come to that, but let's not look at them for too long. And then, of course, there's all the revelations that we have been hearing And that people have found the confidence to share, including hundreds of these kinds of stories. And it's really difficult to, and I was looking at this website, I was like, oh my God, I can't, I got to stop looking at this website. And these are not, I picked ones that are not, well, I don't know. They're all, they're just, they speak for themselves. And we also have data. We have like a shit ton of data as well as people's stories. We have survey after survey. And if we're talking about sexuality and gender identity, we keep doing the same surveys and they keep telling us the same thing. If you have a sexuality that's not heterosexuality, or even if you're perceived to be not heterosexual, and if you have a gender identity that doesn't conform to all of these restraints, gender normative behavior, if you're gender non-conforming, which let's all please be that, then you are subject to bullying, harassment, discrimination, prejudice. You feel uncomfortable or unsafe at school in most cases. You feel unsafe or uncomfortable at work. You don't hear stories about yourself. You don't see yourself. And you probably have experienced some form of actual harassment. And I remember thinking when we started Safe Schools in 2010, like, how many times do you just have to keep waving this evidence in the face of people? And I think a lot of the young people who were shocked at the backlash against Safe Schools thought that same thing. Like, how can politicians be so heartless? How can so many people who could do something about this, our school principal, you know, our local councillors, who have this evidence and they know about suicide rates and they know it actually it's not some dramatic thing to try to make that slightly better, and they don't do anything. And people say it makes no sense. It makes no sense that they won't fucking do anything. People are killing themselves. It's awful. And so this talk is partly answering that question as well. Why don't they do anything about it? In fact, why do they continue to create those conditions? There's another parade of scumbags. I stopped adding photos of these scumbags because there's like a new one every day. But just a couple of my personal adversaries, pretty shit adversaries really, but George Christensen and Corey Bernardi, who were massively agitated around Safe Schools, Erica Betts, who's been making comments recently, and then the defence minister, because I just wanted to include, and I'm sure we'll talk about this a bit, but it's not just men who are sexist scumbags or homophobes or transphobes, and it's not just straight people, actually. One of the worst people around Safe Schools was gay Liberal MP Tim Wilson, who really tried to get me sacked before anyone else did, and, yeah, led the way as a gay man in saying what was so wrong with Safe Schools. The parade of scumbags. Okay, well, this is a nicer image, and I guess it's the beginning of explaining how we find out what's at the roots of this oppression. So Marxism is a theory that says through the whole of history, the way that life has been organised and society has been organised has changed, and it's changed dramatically. And in order to try to figure out why things are how they are today and why the kind of ideas that get generated and spread and shared and become so powerful in society get to be so powerful, we have to dig beneath those ideas and say, what's the material basis of that society? And that means going back to the very basics of how do people get the things they need to survive and how are those things produced? And you'll hear that talked about a lot at this conference. So I'm not the first person to talk about it. But it's really interesting. You don't have to look too far to find examples of history. And I encourage people to think critically about the history you read as well, and the archaeology and the reports and the science that's put forward, like evolutionary psychology and pseudoscience like that, I would call it. Because there's no such thing as neutral science or neutral history. So as Marxists, we've also had to, I say, dig a bit deeper in relation to archaeology, and it's a bad pun, but we've had to scratch the surface. No, okay. But we look for evidence that shows us things like this that was found recently, actually, a burial pit with a probably they estimate she was 17 to 19 years old, a young woman who was buried with her own set of stone tools that were used for big game hunting, four spear points that she would have hurled at these things that are like a sort of llama version of a llama. But what this means is, so you might remember the llama from this session, what this means is that whole narrative of history saying hunters and gatherers and men did the hunting and all this kind of crap, like, it's not true. The evidence doesn't suggest that. There's plenty of alternative societies. You just have to look for them and understand and interpret. And imagine being a fucking 18-year-old young woman throwing spears at llamas and then make Christian Porter the llama. And so we get to the point then, through looking at that history, of understanding that we're in a time period now, and it's a very short period of history that's been named capitalism. It's a tiny fucking dot in the history of humanity, and we're in it, and we're going to have to be the ones who do something about it, because it's a shit moment in history, capitalism. And if we want to sum up what that moment in history is, it's to say that there's a small group of people who compete with each other to extract surplus value or profits from the mass of the rest of us, the working class. And that everything we need to live in this society, so again, how do we produce what we need, comes from people trying to make profit out of producing those things, not helping people live better lives. And so our class position in that system shapes every aspect of our lives and every other social relationship that we have. So even if we wanted to kind of have different relationships, and we can and we do and we can try, we kind of can't escape that central dynamic that's shaped by our class position. And so all the other constructions, I think, can be understood through that. So our genders and our sexualities included. Now, I've come up with a fancy new graphic that's a first for Marxism conferences. I think it's really useful, and I'll explain it a bit more. But it's to say that there are these two central dynamics at work that I think underpin and can explain the roots of gender and sexual oppression. And yeah, the arrows go both ways around. So there's exploitation at work, and I'll talk about that, and there's oppression at home. And so there's production and profit, and there's reproduction and the family, and that those two central structural features of capitalism then influence a whole set of gendered ideas and stereotypes and expectations that also shape the decisions we are forced to make or choose to make or think that we make by choice of how to live in our relationship with others, which then feeds back into those same two central dynamics about work and about home and the family. So I'm going to start with exploitation at work. Ooh, you might not be able to see these graphs at the back, but don't worry, it's stats. And I believe these stats because they're collected by agencies that don't have an interest in distorting the reality of these statistics, because they'd actually prefer them not to be like this. So, for example, what we know at work is that there's a gender pay gap. And the gender pay gap is currently 15%, and it goes sort of up and down, fluctuates between 15 and 20%. And we know that there was some celebration, or not celebration, there was a marking of the fact that it's been more than 50 years since we had a law that said you're not allowed to pay women and men differently at work. More than 50 years, right? And this gender pay gap continues to exist. In full-time work, the gender pay gap means that men earn nearly $27,000 a year more than women working full-time. And for women who've had children over their lifetime, two equivalent people with university degrees, the man would earn $3.3 million on average, and the woman would earn $1.8 million over her lifetime. That's a shit ton of money that that women don't have. But then who does end up with that money that is not paid to women? And if you calculate it, if you sort of added up that pay gap with every single woman and the money that they're not paid, and then thought about how much is going into the pockets of the bosses and the managers and the shareholders, you can see that that's a pretty good business rationale for the ruling class and the bosses to try to maintain that pay gap and actually to grow it as much as possible and to put pressure on it at all times and to not really investigate it properly or whatever. So every dollar they don't pay women ends up in their bank accounts. And we also know that it's even greater in particular concentrations of industry and occupation that women dominate. And so that's what that graph with the dots and whatnot means. Basically, the more women are employed in an industry, the lower the pay is overall. So there you get whole sections of industry where bosses know they can make more money because it's mostly women in the workforce. And partly if you go back to that kind of cycle of where the ideas come from as well, the ideology around women just love to care for people and they're happy to be nurses and whatever, and therefore they're not as concerned about how much they get paid, feeds in and supports that and then is reinforced by the fact that they don't earn as much and, you know, that's not really changing. So it's devalued work, right? So it provides massive financial gains for the rich. And it means that even if ideas about gender shifts, there's still an economic imbalance that influences decision-making about which parent stays at home to look after children, which is much, much more often women in heterosexual relationships. And it also affects whether people leave relationships that they don't want to be in, unhealthy relationships, and it's sort of really obvious how many of them exist in society. So that's one aspect. Then there's the family. Oh, that's a nicer family. Hey, I got to have Leo in my slides. And here's some other graphics. So we're all taught, and there's a very strong set of ideas about family being the most important thing in our lives. It's really drummed in. You know what? Sometimes I, just for social research, watch reality TV shows, right? And every single contestant, I like to call them, on a reality TV show, when asked what's most important in your life, will say, oh, family. Family is the most important thing to me. And I don't think it's because they're making that up. I don't think it's not genuine, but it's just like, Jesus, this really is such a dominant idea. And for somebody to say, oh, I don't give a shit about family. I don't give a shit about my family. Fucking, I don't want a family. People would find that, like, imagine if you work, like, going into your tea break room or whatever and saying, fucking family, fuck that shit. I mean, sometimes if people are having a bad day, they say it, but they're like, no, but deep down, family is the most important. It's an extremely powerful ideology, right? Every children's bloody book, I know more about that now. Politicians can say, I want to spend more time with my family, and everyone's like, oh, good, yep, great, legit. So I'm not going to actually argue, it may surprise you, that it's radical to be anti-family, because actually I don't think it is. But we can have a radical critique of the family and the way that it operates in capitalism. And we can think of much less rigid ways to think about family and kinship and how human beings like to relate to each other, which I think is totally fine. So why is the family so important to capitalism? Well, it's been required a particular type of reproductive family in two senses. Families reproduce people who are fit to work. Are you fit to work? Well, then you shouldn't be claiming that benefit. No. Workers who are ready to go into workplaces, do the job, get paid a fraction of the value that they produce, and the boss gets to take the rest. Those people need to be housed and fed and clothed and sleep somewhere, and that's in houses with their families, and that's actually more and more the only affordable thing to do as well. And it's reproductive in a second sense. It's reproductive ideologically. So a whole heap of the central ideas that we have about the basic things about the world that are called common sense, you get from your family life. And you pass the wand to your family, even if you're not consciously doing it. And most of it is not some conscious, you know, I'm going to indoctrinate my children with ideas about discipline or whatever. It's no, stop fucking playing with that thing. Come over here, you know, do what you're told. And a heap of those ideas are about gender and sexuality and relationships, how to fit in to society, the pressure to fit in with all of the ideas that help capitalism continue to exploit people. And school backs up all of those ideas. And schools and family work together as two kind of ideological units. Families also look after people with disabilities, and that's increasingly privatised through NDIS and put back into the home. Older people, and if you can't look after your older people at home, then you have to pay for them to be looked after by someone else with your money or the money that they've spent their whole life earning, whatever. And what's the value of all of this work that goes on? And just the value of the women who do this work, if you add up all of the hours that women do reproductive labour in the home, you might say, at a minimum wage in a year internationally, so that's a big number. It's $10.9 trillion. So again, who benefits from that? The capitalist system, the people at the top, the managers, the bosses, the ruling class. Cha-ching, that's a big fucking cha-ching, $10.9 trillion. I got the zeros right on that number, dollars. So traditional family values, you hear a lot about, and you've heard a lot about from the same politicians now who are having all these revelations about their disgusting fucking behaviour. There seems to be a correlation between the people who've been the most family values and the ones who are now getting caught out having been the most disgustingly sexist. But it's not just the far right who talk about family values and mean really the same thing. It's the Labour Party, working families. The Greens talk about working families. It's the same set of ideas, just used in a slightly different way, because the Liberals, the Australian Conservatives, the Labour Party, the Greens are all for capitalism staying pretty much the same way as it is. And homophobia stems from all of this, transphobia, sexism, also act as a form of social control. And I don't have heaps of time to talk about this, but like, the idea that, you know, we should be so focused on our genders and sexualities and how we enact them and what our relationships are like and all of those kind of things. And there's so much that swirls around really on that. It means that you're not thinking, oh, the system is fucked and I'm going to like organize with my work weights and do something about it. Actually, I'm like, being homophobically bullied at work and I've got to deal with that, or by my boss potentially, which has happened to me, or, you know, just worrying about all of that kind of stuff and the level of anxiety that people have and young people have now about relationships and sexuality and gender identity means that you're doing that and not thinking about tearing the fucking guts out of the system. So that's handy as well, right, for the capitalist class. And families might be adaptable, and sometimes people will say, yeah, but, you know, there's same-sex parented families and there's diverse families today, but, like, you still actually have to do all the same bloody work. I mean, yeah, you don't get a childcare discount because you're a lesbian. I tried, but they... But it's still, you have to do the same things. It's still just as tiring and hard, and you're still responsible for your family in the same way, right? So it doesn't actually make, you know, the family is flexible enough, but as long as it's doing what it's supposed to be doing to benefit capitalism. And so the ideas that we have all relate to these core structures of exploitation at work and the institution of the family. And we can understand that, which makes it so frustrating when the response to what has been going on in Parliament, and even by people who consider themselves progressive and left-wing, is we need to raise more awareness about sexism or sexist behaviour. We need to educate people better. We need to train them how to be empathic when they're actually a psychopathic, fucking ruling class, bigoted, sexist fucker, man or woman or any gender, you know. They're not going to be trained to be empathic. Like, what kind of crazy idea is that? But it's a comfortable idea, right? It's a comfortable idea to say, there's all of this sexism going on. If only we explained it to people and it was sexist. Like, actually, I think if you were a, God forbid, if you were a room full of boys at a, from an elite private school, and I taught you everything I know about consent, and I did it in all these amazing pedagogical ways, which I could do, I think there would be people in the room who would still go and sexually assault people and rape people, because some of these boys already fucking know. They know there's no consent and they do it anyway. It's not because they don't know. It's because they think they have a right to it, because they're entitled. They've been brought up to be entitled, and they've been brought up like that their whole life, and their school reinforces it every single day. And their friends reinforce it. So training them, educating them is kind of an insult, I think. But it also doesn't get to the heart of what I've been trying to argue here around there are some structures going on under the surface, and we can look at them and we can start to think about, well, what do we want to do? Because our ideas are shaped by all of these social relations, and they're kind of invisible social relations a lot of the time. It's so naturalized, capitalism. It's hundreds and thousands of interactions that we have with each other that shape our behaviors, our desires. We probably don't really know what our desires are. We don't know what they are outside of capitalism. And that's what Engels was saying. We won't know what they are really until we have a different structure in society that can allow us to figure out what they are. So there's just a couple more things I want to point to and then I'll sum up. But there's a whole crazy, there's a couple of industries that show us that this is not changing. Yeah, I mean, pregnant Barbie is out of control. This sums it up. You can be pregnant Barbie or office Barbie. Oh, no, you've got to be sexy Barbie before you can be pregnant Barbie. And then you can go back to office Barbie and then maybe another pregnant Barbie. And but, like, these two industries really, I think, absolutely, like, get rid of the argument that we're slowly moving to a less sexist society. A study has been done of toy advertising and toy production. And then it's shown, and this was a survey of, like, heaps of toy adverts and production. Toys were more sexist in 2014 than they were in 1964. It's not actually getting any better. People can run these kind of campaigns and it's fine, but, like, sexism is not going away. And advertising is another industry that you just really, like, the most disgusting, vile, sexist, misogynist images. And the more high-end the brand it seems to be, the more disgusting the kind of, what is this gang, like, assault Dolce & Gabbana and this jewelry company. Like, and these are recent adverts. If you had this advert in a workplace, thankfully, you could probably complain to your health and safety rep, and that would be sexual assault. But you can put it in a magazine or a billboard that every kid can see and whatever, right? This is the advertising industry. This is a good little rebuke to some of the fucking shit advertising. So what can we do about it? Okay. Relationships between people in capitalism are so perverse, really, that they continue to create stark contradictions, and people can see it, they can feel it, they can think this is not quite right. All of the expectations, like, I was doing this class the other day, and I teach people how to teach sex ed, right? I teach primary teachers how to teach sex ed. And a bunch of the people in my classes who are maybe, you know, in their early 20s are quite often learning the content that I'm telling them to teach the primary school because they've never had proper sex ed, right? And they sort of, you can see them coming to these conclusions around, wait a second, you're right. It is impossible to meet the standards of what people expect girls to be like and young women to be like. It's an impossible contradiction to be sexy but not too sexy, smart but not too smart, like opinionated but not too opinionated. Like there's no way of getting it right. And you can feel that, right? It's a contradiction that's there all the time. But the root of all of our alienation is that central thing again, that mode of production of capitalism. That means that the fundamental thing that human beings do that's different to other animals, that's to work, that's to labour on things, to make things, is alienated and exploited. And we can't choose what we make and what we have and what we don't have. All of that is taken away from us by the system, and that fucks us all up. That alienates us in ways that affect every other dynamic, including gender, which is used against us, including our sexualities, which is used against us. But the biggest contradiction in capitalism, the biggest contradiction is that the people who make everything, the oppressed class, workers of all genders, are also the most potentially able to smash the system. And that's the contradiction that Marx and Engels and all the Marxists since then have wanted you to grasp. And not just to grasp it, but to do something about it. And there are people doing something about it, right? And we'll hear from them all weekend. There's the women in Argentina, and we heard from one of them this morning, who have done something about some of those contradictions that they've faced around abortion rights. And there's the women in Myanmar. And I wanted to end with this because it's amazing. One of the tactics was to set up these barricades of women's clothes, in particular like undergarments, that the army felt like it was sort of jinx. They were jinx. It was like a thing that they couldn't go past them because it's bad luck and it does things to their virility. So they covered all the streets with these clothes, like, and then the army just actually stopped, right, for a while because they didn't want to. It's fantastic, ingenious, creative. And women's labour unions and garment workers organised, and they are grasping at that contradiction and realising that they have a lot of power, not just in the streets, but by walking out of the factories, by stopping that creation of value, of profits, and they're starting to use that power. And the more they organize with other workers and not just women, they're going and trying to get the men to come out on strike with them, that they can really start to feel that power having some effect. And just finally, well, you can read this, but there are young women around the world fighting and have given their lives to this struggle, that we and every single person in this room, whether you know it or not, you're here at Marxism 2021. You're now part of that struggle. And you're part of the struggle in Myanmar, and you're part of an international movement of Marxists and socialists who don't just want to smash sexism, who don't just want to fucking never see Christian Porter again, but who want to smash the entire rotten, exploitative, class-based, oppressive, disgusting system that is capitalism, and I'm glad you're doing it with me. Thank you.